What's the difference between coring and flotation?
How do commercial archaeology companies make money?
And is doing things the old-fashioned way sometimes the best way to get results?
Answers to those questions and more with a special guest on this episode of the Time Team podcast.
Hello and welcome to our new episode of the Time Team podcast.
Yeah, welcome once again. Great to have you with us. And it's all about the questions and it's all about hopefully the answers as well on this particular edition of the podcast. And I mentioned, Helen, a special guest as well, didn't I, a moment ago?
That's right. And we have got Time Team's Gus Casely-Hayford, OBE, with us today. And Gus, your current job is as the first ever director of V&A East, isn't it? The new project of the Victoria and Albert Museum. How's that going and what are you working on at the moment?
Yeah, I feel very privileged to hold this role. It's a brand new Victoria and Albert Museum, which is opening up not very long, actually. It's at the end of May, our storehouse, which holds about 250,000 objects and 1,000 archives, about the size of a football stadium. And it's in East London on the old Olympic Park. And then we're building a new museum, which will open up this time next year. And so that's kind of filling a lot of my time. But of course, Time Team, my kind of true love, is something that I absolutely kind of adore alongside it.
Well, we are so glad to have you with us and we can't wait to ask you some questions as well as Helen. Helen, have you yet managed to sort of poke your nose in at the V&A East? I know it's sort of they're setting it up at the moment.
No, I haven't. This is what I wanted to find out, exactly when I can go and have a look at it. So the store, the accessible storage is opening in May. So that's when researchers and so on and the general public, can anybody go in or is it just researchers?
And that's the beauty of it. Unlike other museum stores, this is a space that anyone can come in. You don't even have to have an appointment. You can come in. We've created an app that you have on your phone and you can select any 5 items. They can be brought to you and you can have hands-on time with those items. And this is about a collection which belongs to the public and finding the simplest way in which we can give the public access to these objects. And I've spent a lot of the last 2 years taking objects into schools for young people to get up close to. More than I think 30,000 young people have had hands-on time with our objects, and just the power that they possess to really engage people is really, I found, very affecting. So I can't wait to invite young people into our spaces, because with 250,000 of them, there are all sorts of stories to tell.
And older people as well, because we want to have a nosy round. We want to see what's going on. Well, speaking of objects, I should just let you know that as well as answering your questions, because that is what this episode is all about, answering questions that you've been asking on Patreon. And Gus is going to have a go, I hope, if that's okay, Gus, at answering some of these questions too and chipping in alongside Helen. But we've also got Helen's find to bring to you as well. And Helen's been having a little think about an object, an item that perhaps tells a story. We will get to what that object is in just a few moments, but let's dive straight in, if it's okay with you two, with question number one here. This has come from Carrie Astry, who says this, and a bit of background here, Gus, for you. This relates to a conversation that we've been, quite a long-running conversation we've been having about the prevalence of stairs in Roman buildings and being able to prove whether stairs existed or not. Like, how do you know that stairs were there? How do you know that there was an upper floor? If the stairs were wood and there's no evidence for them, you know, we're just supposing that they used stairs, but how do we know? And that all came about from original Patreon question, and it got Helen so interested, and we had the whole episode just devoted to talking about stairs. So this is sort of carrying on from that. Given the design of tall, lofty spaces in Mediterranean buildings assisting with keeping buildings cool, I would have thought that in cold and wet Britain, this would be counterintuitive, and perhaps lower/single-story spaces would retain the heat better and therefore need no stairs. Standing in the recreation of the double height Roman buildings in South Shields over winter, it was pretty freezing, and any heat would be lost in the roof space. And here comes the question. Were all these Roman buildings being built around Britain all following the Mediterranean design ideas, regardless of the local climate? So did they have a sort of copy and paste thing that they were doing where they just went along and went, right, we want to build a Roman villa. This is how we always build Roman villas wherever we build them. Or were they being more specific to the area and the climate that they were in?
Well, yes, that is a really good question. And I have to say that being a bit of a novice in this Roman villa land, I only know at the moment about British buildings, and I don't know how well they follow the Roman pattern. But I do know that there is the corridor system where you get to your individual buildings by going along a corridor. That is, as far as I understand, a classical thing. But what I want to do is ask Gus, because Gus, you've got a background in, your original background was in African art, wasn't it? I'm hoping you've got some knowledge of perhaps building types in maybe North Africa or whatever, because mine, admittedly, very slight knowledge is that they tend to be single story with a roof that you can use as another outdoor place.
They can be single story, but in places like Mali and in places like Morocco, that there were cultures that had kind of multi-story buildings with floors at multiple levels. I think that was kind of, you know, long established. And I think particularly what they were very good at is engineering buildings that could naturally kind of ventilate themselves to be able to control the temperatures. And then the Almohads and the Almoravids, that they, in the medieval period, that they actually kind of colonize southern Spain. And they take some of those kinds of building traditions and technologies northward. And even though, I mean, the temperatures are pretty kind of ferocious in southern Spain, but some of those technologies, particularly around water management, you know, you can see those and they become aesthetic. So in places like Alhambra, what would have in a Moroccan context have been in part aesthetic, but also about irrigation and the carrying of water for use in domestic situations, it becomes something which is more connected to gardens and rest and beauty. So I wonder whether in this context that, you know, it may have been something which would have been, even though probably not kind of architecturally effective, it may have been aesthetic.
Yes, so that what people want to see becomes more important perhaps than their experience within the building, and maybe they tweak their experience so that they can have several stories and yet keep them all warm. Because of course the traditional Roman way of heating your house, the top flight high status way, is to have a hypocaust underneath your tiled floor so that you've got underfloor heating, and that only works on the ground floor, and you then have to hope that it kind of wafts its way up a bit. But I suppose one of the problems as well is that I don't yet know what people are suggesting these upper floors were used for. But I have had a tip. I mean, we haven't yet, Martin, have we, given reading lists with this podcast, but I have
it's coming.
I have been given a tip by an old friend, David Neal, who's a mosaics expert, and he told me that he wrote a paper in 1982 called Roman Villas One Story or Two. He's absolutely convinced they were two-storied in Britain as well as in the Mediterranean, but wow. I have to say I haven't managed to track that article down yet, you know. It's pretty ancient and the print run was probably only ever about 500. So I've got to read that and find out what he thought back in 1982 and then grill him about it. Because I keep seeing all these ideas about how they could have been two-storied and they might have been, or they might not have been, or they might have been desired to be like that and it might not have worked. But common sense is such a bad guide to the past. And what we really need to know is what actually happened, not what probably happened.
the part of living in spaces is falling in love with them, and the romance, the stories, the traditions of making. And it may well be that some of these spaces, they weren't wholly practical, but that they, you could imagine how they would have spoken to history and tradition and would have looked and felt right. You know, you could imagine the aesthetic balance of a property, and that, you know, if people were used to particular building conventions, of being loath to lose that second floor, because they could imagine how their ancestors would have also have hankered after similar kinds of building.
It seems like the question of stairs or no stairs will just haunt us forever. We will never find an answer to this question. But I think that's fine. It's all part of learning, isn't it? Carrie Astry, thank you so much for your question. Really good and great to kick us off. I should say, by the way, if you have a question listening to this and you think, oh, I've got a question that I reckon that it would be really interesting to get an answer from an actual archaeologist, and well, you can do that right now. It's so easy to do it. You just go to our Patreon at Time Team Official. So patreon.com/timeteamofficial, and you can add your question there. There, just comment on any post that you see that's vaguely about the podcast, and we will see it. Helen's Fine coming in a moment after this question from Fiona, who has obviously been listening to a previous episode of the podcast that we did, which featured Naomi Supal, Time Team's very own, and her amazing flotation tank. It's a really cool thing to watch, and it feels like you're sort of in a spa because you get to hear all these lovely noises of the running water, but it serves a really important archaeological process, which Helen is going to summarize in just a moment. But the question from Fiona is, what is the difference between coring and what Naomi does? Now, we've talked about coring as well on the podcast, haven't we? So I think there's just a little bit of confusion there as to what the terms are and what they mean and how each of them are. So Helen, can we have a sort of potted explanation of each so that we can clearly see the difference and how one might be used rather than the other?
Absolutely, yes. Coring is just a way of recovering a sample. So Naomi works on samples, bits of earth that can reasonably be expected to contain evidence for the past environment. So you could get these from a soil column, which is a box that's knocked into the section of a trench and takes a chunk down through the vertical side of the trench. So that's down through time. It could be a grab sample, which is just what it says, really. You just grab a bit from a feature. It can be a 100% sample, which is all of a feature taken and given to Naomi to work her magic. Or it could be a cored sample, which is the auger taking a core, a cylindrical sample down into the ground, many meters in some cases. And then Naomi can either take the whole of that, or more likely she'd take little bits, little chunks from here, there, and so on, down that column of earth. And she'd be able to use those to tell you how the environment had changed over time. So it's a bit like a column, but it's a long cylindrical one rather than a short rectangular one, so to speak. So once she's got her sample, whether it's through coring or excavation or grab or whatever, she then will float it. And flotation is where you pop your soil into an agitated amount of water. You know, you put it into water, you shake it around, and the light things float to the top. So hopefully the stones drop to the bottom, the things like bone, snail shells, insect, beetle cases, that kind of thing, all the big light stuff and small light stuff too, but I was thinking of big rather than tiny, like pollen, so it's macro fossils rather than micro fossils. That floats to the top, and then, you know, the fountain that goes in off the top of the tank into the first sieve, and then the second sieve and the third sieve, that collects the bigger, medium and smaller things in the sieve. Then at the bottom, the sludge. Now, I must say, I understand flotation. I don't quite understand what Naomi does with her sludge. That might be a question for another day.
That's between Naomi and herself, I think.
Because I know the stones are taken out, but she has found sometimes the most interesting things in the non-stone sludge. So that is my next question for her next time I see her and her tank. What do you do with your sludge?
It's such a beautiful process to observe. And then alongside the actual kind of the process of watching this, you know, water being decanted and kind of filtering. Alongside all of that is then Naomi, her particular kind of interpretation of what one sees, because, you know, for me, it looks so fine and just almost imperceptible differences between different kinds of material. But through Naomi's eyes, one can then begin to read the different sorts of things that have been pulled from whatever material is being analysed. And it is kind of like a form of alchemy. It's absolutely beautiful to watch and just magical to see it kind of unfold in the hands of someone who is completely masterful like Naomi in the delivery of it.
Absolutely.
And I just think it sounds great. especially when it's a really hot day, you just wanted to be next to the flotation tent because you feel like you're on a beach or in a beautiful woodland or something like that, next to a babbling brook. It's very, very nice indeed. Thank you, Fiona. Great question, and I hope that has cleared it up and maybe just given you a little bit more of an idea of, certainly for me as well, what was quite interesting is how the two things link together, how you can take a core and then use flotation to find out something about the core sample that you have just taken. Right, more questions to come in just a moment, but we're going to pause now. The two of us, Gus and I, are going to pause because we're going to hand the floor over to Helen and Helen's Find, which is a section of this bit of the podcast where I invite Helen to suggest an object or an item with historical, with archaeological relevance. And the floor is yours. Helen, what item are you bringing to my attention this time?
Well, today I am bringing to your attention a prehistoric object, and there won't be many times when I do this, Martin, because I am not an expert in the world of prehistory, but I am an expert in the world of metalworking, and this object tells us so much about Bronze Age metalworking, and it's also exceptionally beautiful. It's a thing called a penannular ring, and a lot of objects in the Bronze Age are called by a kind of description because we don't know what they were for, and this one is no exception. It's a big fat sausage turned into a ring with straight ends that almost meet each other. So it's a bit like a polo mint, which you've taken out a tiny slice from.
And is it about the size of a polo mint?
No, it's bigger. It's more like the size of a Strepsil, a large boiled sweet, maybe a 10p piece, okay. A pound coin. I'm trying to think of things that will mean something to other people.
A quarter? A quarter. If you're in the US, 10p is about the size of a quarter. Yeah.
But they're very thick. The proportion is, have you ever seen a woodlouse curling itself into a, I think they're called pill bugs sometimes, aren't they? It looks a bit like that. And the nicest ones have got stripes on them. They're covered in gold. Some may be solid gold, but most seem not to be solid gold. They've got something else in the middle, like ceramic or copper alloy or sometimes even wax. And the outside is wrapped in gold that's done so perfectly that you wouldn't know that it wasn't solid gold. But it's decorated with stripes, sometimes very tightly packed, sometimes very loosely wound. They're a spiral of wire that has been added and then beaten into the surface. And these stripes are a kind of silvery colour. But in the Bronze Age, they couldn't extract pure silver, so they're not actually silver. What they are is a kind of naturally occurring silvery gold. It's a different colour, but it's still basically gold, and it's known as electrum a lot of the time in modern parlance. So they find sources of gold with a different colour and inlay this spiral of wire. And the whole thing is polished to look absolutely solid, and it's the only multicoloured thing that we have from the Bronze Age. They're so remarkable and extraordinary, and they're actually quite common. You know, we've got hundreds of these things on the Portable Antiquities Scheme database, more than any other gold object. They take up quite a lot of gold, and yet we don't know what they are. There's been a suggestion that they might be ornaments, bodily ornaments, to be worn on the body because, well, that's what we think most Bronze Age gold things are. You carry your wealth on your body, and perhaps these in some way bound something. So the little space in the middle is not very big. The ends, the terminals, are very fat. So they're probably not earrings going through a hole in the earlobe, but they could be like a kind of ear cuff, although they're very big. It has been suggested that they're septum rings. So you have them in your nose, rather like a bull ring, something like that. But they could obviously slide on and off. And the thing we really need to do is we need to do a bit of experimentation. Somebody needs to make some of these. We need to all try to slide them onto our nose and see if that works, how heavy they are, how annoying. But they were clearly not just worn by one or two people because they're so common. But they've never been found in a grave. They've never been found in situ on a body. So they are really, really, really mysterious. If you go to the Portable Antiquities Scheme website and you type in penannular ring and you choose Bronze Age, you can scroll through all the images and see what I'm talking about. I'm dealing with one of them just at the moment, which is being acquired by Norwich Castle Museum, where I've got two colours in that silvery gold. It's kind of silvery on the outside of each stripe, but it's brown on the inside. And I do not understand what that means, but there's a project at Leicester University which is looking at Bronze Age metalwork and analysing it. And I'm going to ask them if they wouldn't mind analysing this one, because it just seems so remarkable that a society that has so little technology is managing to produce such complicated metalwork.
As an art historian, can I ask though the question, in terms of the kind of the finish, do you get a sense that they were created in a way that someone would give one of these to someone else that they cared about? Is it something that you would value for its aesthetic merit, or is it something that you get a sense that this had a practical application and they were making multiple versions of these, even though they obviously kind of cared about how they looked?
I really don't get a sense that there's anything practical about this. I cannot work out why there's a circular hole in the middle, then these two terminals that are very close to each other. What is all that about in terms of practical considerations? Because they could, of course, have made them proper full round rings if they wanted to. They don't have to have that little gap. It would have been just as easy, if not easier, to make them completely round. And so if you're stringing them on a necklace, say, not that that's at all practical either. I mean, they just seem to have no practical use at all. And the quality of the finish, they're all quite highly polished, but some are pure gold, no stripes. The stripy ones vary from really tightly packed, really carefully done stripes to some quite loose and irregular stripes. So implying either that there's a variation in the skill of the metal worker, or if the metal workers are all really incredibly skilled, someone's commissioning them with the less good stripes. What is it? What does any of that mean? And as a medievalist, my overriding feeling about this is what we have lost, what we don't know about the Bronze Age, and further back, what we don't know about the Stone Age. I mean, one of my most memorable afternoons culminated with Phil Harding driving me home from a Time Team excavation, 40 minutes, where he, I can't remember how we got onto the subject of this, but he told me about twisted ovate hand axes, and I was mesmerised by how he said that they're like drops of water that have just been frozen in that act of falling and slightly twisting, like a wind has blown a drop of water. They've made that out of stone. This went on for 40 minutes, and and I was just amazed by his passion about them. But all of that happened in a society about which we know almost nothing about the way that they thought, the way that they loved, the way that they laughed and wept, and their poetry, their songs, their dance. You know, we've lost all of that. And it strikes me as so sad that what they knew has all been lost.
But what's not sad about it, what is absolutely glorious, is that even with that mystery, what isn't mysterious is that someone loved both someone and the process of making enough to spend this time focused around developing the skills, holding these traditions, creating variations around a particular kind of obvious set of conventions, as you described them. and that these things mattered. And someone probably made this thing who was who had great skill that may have been inherited from someone else. And then they chose to give that thing to someone else. And that sense of connectivity that was shared between two people, all of that time back in history, is something that we can still relate to. We still can understand both the care of the making, but also the connectivity in wanting to give something of that level of quality to someone else because you cared about them.
Yes, so tiny and yet containing so much hard work. Yes, absolutely.
You have come up trumps there, Helen, big time. That is fascinating and a real mystery to get everybody thinking as well. I like that. We will do Helen's find on another edition of the Time Team podcast. This is the Time Team podcast. Martin Williams here alongside Dr. Helen Geek and Gus Casely Hayford, OBE, who is joining in the answering of your questions on Patreon. And thank you so much for submitting them, by the way, if you've done that. We always need more. We really want more. So please do, if you're a Patreon supporter, and if you're not, become one and head on to Patreon, patreon.com/timeteamofficial, and then you just comment on a post about one of the podcasts and I will see your message and we will include your question in a future edition. Let's move on to question number three. Are you enjoying this, by the way, Gus? I'm just checking. I think it's fascinating, these questions, and it's just...
It is very fascinating. Absolutely. Loving it. Thank you.
Here is Frank Pello, and Frank asks, can you explain the relationship between Time Team and Wessex Archaeology, please? Now, we mention companies like Wessex Archaeology quite a lot because they do a lot of work for us, and maybe we don't explain enough about who they are and exactly what they do. Frank says, I often see them mentioned and I wonder which elements of the dig they are responsible for. They do feature, we do work with companies, like, because it's not just Wessex, there are other companies as well that do these. These are commercial archaeology companies who we work with. And what is their role, Helen?
Gosh, well, I think one of the things about being an archaeologist is that you tend to explain things in chronological order. So I want to go back to the early years of Time Team to start this explanation, which is that in the first few years, Mick was very hot on the idea of publication. It's always been an absolute archaeological principle that you haven't finished your fieldwork, because your fieldwork is destructive. You haven't finished it until you've turned that into a record and put that out to the public. So it needs to be published. If anybody wants to know why we said something on a Time Team programme, they ought to be able to go to the records and find out exactly what we found and to know whether we were right or not, so to speak. So the idea is that you replace the archaeology with a record and you could mentally re-excavate the site from the records. That's the ideal. And Time Team, of course, taking just 3 days, it didn't seem to be an enormous amount of records. And so there were a few ad hoc arrangements in the early years. I think Mick got some students to write some up and this, that and the other. Then somebody was employed to do a year's worth here and a year's worth there. But it was all quite ad hoc and it was quite difficult to find the record if you wanted to. It went into the historic environment record of each county. It went off to the record office. It stayed with the landowner, that kind of thing, but it wasn't publicly available. And then I don't know who, probably Phil Harding, said, well, we could just do this the same way as you do any other archaeological excavation and employ somebody, a unit, a commercial unit, a large commercial unit, to take over the writing up. And he said, well, why not Wessex Archaeology, seeing as I worked for them, Phil worked for them, not me. So he probably said, why not just use the unit that he worked for at the time, which was Wessex Archaeology. So Wessex used to send two people, one to do the finds, because a lot of the records depend on study of the finds after the excavation, and one to do the rest of the recording, and they would write it up each time. And so every report made its way onto Wessex Archaeology's website. So you can go and look at all those 3 days. If you just Google Wessex Archaeology Time Team, you'll find all of those reports. That carried on up to when we stopped doing terrestrial television, and then when we came back, because it wasn't quite so regular and everything was a bit more variable, we've started using different organisations for different things. So we have quite a good working relationship with Cotswold. They quite often do our writing up, but not all the time. Sometimes it's more logical to ask somebody else to do it. But everything is still written up. And given that we have our own website these days, we could probably, I don't quite know where everything is at the moment, but everything ought to make its way onto a website where it's really easy to find. There are repositories like the Archaeology Data Service in York that we could use, but I think it would be probably easier for everybody to find if we just stick all those reports onto our website. So that, in short, that was the long answer. The short answer is they write things up and make them available to the public.
In short, they do a lot of writing. And I think they do excavations themselves. And Gus, I suppose
they write up our sites, but they also provide us with people like Jackie McKinley, who works for them. And of course, this is just a tiny bit of what Wessex Archaeology do. They're one of the biggest units in the country. They work all over the country with developer-funded archaeology. So this is just we're just, I suppose, another contract for them.
Yeah, and I suppose that's interesting, isn't it, Gus? The fact that in a way, yes, they do some great work, and they work with us, and we work with them, but they are they're a commercial company doing this. And it's sort of that, I find that quite interesting, that the process of looking at the past can actually be something that is a business as well as a vocation.
Well, I think that's wonderful. A kind of a mixed ecology of both purpose and funding around this is, I think, a good thing. I mean, this is a sector that requires lots of different kinds of ways of thinking about how we both find the resource, but how we also kind of build broad constituencies to deal with what is a really kind of fascinating kind of set of problems. And so if this is a model that works, I think it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, we are in straitened times, and so if we can be inventive and find the funding from a variety of different sources, I think, yeah, absolutely, more power to their elbow.
The great thing about having large organisations is that somebody like Jackie can spend her entire life working for one organisation but see so much stuff. The reason that Jackie is the person she is she's seen so many cemeteries, so many burials, so many sets of human remains. If everybody was working in their own little tiny organisation, a life spent just working for Time Team, you'd never see quite enough to become a specialist.
Let's get the final question now, shall we? And it comes from Matthew Adams, who asks this: is plaster casting still the best way to capture the detail in the voids in Pompeii? Now, this goes back to the conversation we had about these new excavations they were doing in Pompeii. They poured a plaster down this void where they believed wood would have been, to recreate a table and a bed, because the void was still there but the wood had rotted away, and that's how they did it. Would a scan not do the job less invasively? This is an interesting question, isn't it? Because it's sometimes where technology can not always necessarily give you the best way of doing it or the best answer. And sometimes it is just easy to go back to the old fashioned, put a load of plaster down the hole and recreate it that way, right?
Well, shall I start off with that one? Because I want to find out what Gus thinks about, I want to add in another question there to Gus. My view is that, first of all, I'm not quite sure how we'd do a scan, given that in order to get a camera in, you'd need quite a big space. And the plaster, as it's poured in, only has to get through, it's just a jug of liquid plaster. It needs a tiny little space. The other thing is the invasive nature of it. That area's got to be excavated anyway. So it's a way of keeping that space while you're taking it down. You've got to invade that space anyway. But the thing I want to ask Gus, though, is that if we're going to create an object from a plaster cast, there's something different about actually experiencing it in three dimensions, isn't there?
I agree. And there is, I mean, again, as an art historian, there is something kind of beautiful about kind of creating something solid from what was a void. But additionally, that within the V&A, that, if you kind of walked across the kind of the ground floor of what is a magnificent building, it focuses one's natural attention within the plaster courts, which are a space in which some of the truly greatest pieces of architectural sculpture have been recreated in a plaster kind of cast court. And as a material, it just has this magnificent history of being able to replicate with incredible finesse, huge detail. And, you know, there is a version of Michelangelo's David, which is exquisite. And I can't think of any other material in which you could actually render something which is so precise with such exquisite detail. And so in this sort of kind of use, I would just feel so reassured that it is a material that can tell us very subtle and very kind of fine kinds of story through the ways in which it can settle and set.
You are so right. Because I went to the V&A relatively recently with my teenagers, all of whom are doing art of various kinds, photography, art, film, etc., etc. And we meant to go round the V&A full stop in a day. We hardly made it out of those galleries. They are so incredible. The study of the object and the way that you can experience this plaster cast in a way that you can't with the original, even though, correct me if I'm wrong, Gus, but I think that they were made in order to bring those sculptures that are so sort of far away in the Mediterranean and the classical world,
exactly,
to the British in London. From, yes, what I could see of the plaster cast galleries at the V&A, there hasn't been much new plaster casting done since the 1930s, is that right?
And, that's right, yes.
And I thought to myself, well, why? These are such extraordinary things. We enjoyed them so much. I wish that expertise could be revived and we could again have a department of plaster casting. It would just be great.
That would be magical. That would be.
Oh, well, we'll work on setting one up. Gus, that is it. That's all we have time for. Thank you so much for coming on. We really, really appreciate you being with us. You'll have to come back and do this again because it's been a lot of fun.
I would love to. Thank you so much, Helen. Thank you, Martin. Absolutely love being here.
Thank you so much for being with us, Gus. And thank you for listening to the latest episode of the Time Team podcast.
Next week, I am out and about with our chief metal detectorist, Keith Westcott. I'm going to be looking for some evidence of a Roman villa.
And you'll learn how to do archaeology underwater.
Interesting. Right, we'll speak to you next week.